This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
So our final speaker for today is Dr. Nora Tarot. Should that most of you know Nora. Nora is professor of medicine and surgery and also director of Viral Hepatitis Center. And it's been such a wonderful experience for me to work with Nora all these years, not only because of her expertise and schedule about viral hepatitis, but also with her personality. I just want to tell you, yesterday we were having this monthly hepatology meeting, and we were talking about, the hepatologist should carry this iPad with a neck strap around us walking on the hospital ward just to get more information and data. And guys like me were like, oh yeah, that's a good idea. And then Nora would say, that would not make her look very fashionable. So when you work with people, every day is so much fun. And we really have a great team. So Nora is going to talk to us. This is a really hot topic, hepatitis C, before and after liver transplant. Nora.
So thank you, Francis. I just want you to know that now at the UCSF, we have three faculty that joined us this year. They're all women. So, making fashion statements is actually pretty okay because I'm not alone. I want to thank you all for coming. It's always fantastic to all, to see you all and to see the familiar faces. And I wasn't here last year. I was kind of holding down the fort at UCSF, so I'm really happy to be back. And it's been an amazing year, because this is the year where we saw the approval of the first direct antiviral agent, tenofovir and bosipivir. So what I really want to focus on today is really to sort of really speak to that experience with the PI triple therapy, and then also to give you some glimpse of really what I think is just around the corner. I have some disclosures. These are my various grant support and consulting associations, and I'm going to be discussing the off-label use of both bosipivir and tenofovir in the liver transplant recipients. So again, to this audience, I don't need to remind you, but HCV is the most common indication for liver transplantation. At UCSF, for really most of the last 5 to 7 years, it's accounted for about 50% of our transplants. So it dominates really the scene at UCSF, and that's very typical across the United States. And based on what we know about the sort of epidemic of advanced disease that is predicted, that we're probably going to see this for the next decade or so. And then it'll start to, I think, not be so obvious. And the impact of these new direct antivirals on that sort of numbers needing transplants is really interesting to think about, but my prediction is that's also going to diminish. But at the moment, recurrent disease is universal in those who have viremia prior to transplant, and on average, we have about 8 to 10 years to eradicate the infection post-transplant in order to prevent graft loss. About a third, 20 to 30%, will develop cirrhosis within 5 years. So we have a truncated course for a proportion of our patients. And we've, through many of our studies, learned what that at-risk group is. It's the African Americans, it's women, it's those who received older donors, and it's our HIV co-infected patients. So in those particular individuals, our timeline often for intervention is particularly short. We've also know that eradication of hepatitis C, either before they go to transplant or after, is the surest way of ensuring that they're going to have long-term graft and patient survival. So what I'm going to speak about is really a strategy for both managing the disease before and after. Now, as you know, the PI therapies were approved about a year and a bit ago, and these really were remarkable in terms of what we anticipated in terms of improvements in our overall SVR rates, as shown here. I'll remind you that for both the treatment naive and for the treatment experienced population, that most of the studies were done in non-cirrhotic patients. And so it's kind of really what we've learned in this last year or so is how do these drugs perform when we move into a predominantly cirrhotic population, because that's really who's getting access to these drugs in large numbers. But to make the point that really it pushed the SVR rates well over the 50% range for most of the patient populations of interest, with some caveats for the cirrhotics. So let's talk about pre-transplant treatment. And I'm going to really think about it in two ways. Most of you are thinking about treating the patient who may be a cirrhotic. Maybe they have to be on the list. Maybe they don't. And you're really treating them to get SVR. And that's certainly appropriate. We're going to talk about sort of the kind of national, international experience related to treating cirrhotics. But the other strategy that we talk a lot about at UCSF is our waitlisted patients in whom we're trying to treat them for a more shorter period of time with the goal of making them negative for their virus as they go into transplant. Because we know from prior studies with PEG and ribavirin that patients who are negative going into transplant, that about 50 to 66% of them will then be free of virus post-transplant and not have recurrent risk, a risk for recurrent disease. So it's a strategy of kind of a short course of pre-transplant therapy to prevent recurrent disease. So I'm going to talk about both of them, although in part when we talk about efficacy and tolerability, both populations apply. Now, the main risks with treating cirrhotics that have been established largely through our PEG ribavirin experience is that cytopenias are a big issue, and now with the addition of a PI, anemia is a magnitude higher issue. We have to routinely use growth factors, and blood transfusions are now something that you have to talk to patients about when you're initiating treatment. There's an increased risk of bacterial infections that's been well recognized, but I think now it's become accepted that for patients with cirrhosis, that use of prophylactic antibiotics has some role. And what we all worry about and what you all call me for about should I refer the patient for a transplant is this risk of worsening liver disease in a patient who's got currently compensated cirrhosis. And we really lack but are getting some data about kind of what is the MELD score, what is the CPT score, what is the patient population that needs to be referred and have transplant as backup, and which is the patient that you can feel more comfortable about just treating without that in hand. And the real risk is that worsening liver failure will ultimately result in death. So let's look at the data, and I'm going to refer first to the CUPIC data. This is actually an impressive data set. This is actually from Europe, where they had access to the PIs long before they were approved in the U.S. through a compassionate access program. And so they've got large numbers of patients. There's more than 200 patients in this database that got telaprevir and bosipivir, and they are now reporting their data about treatment of cirrhotics. So to just highlight really what's on this slide, so this is the telaprevir data, and they're looking at 16 weeks of treatment. So these patients all got 12 weeks of telaprevir, PEG, and RIBA, and then we're looking at the sort of 16-week, which is 4 weeks later. And the first thing you'll take away from this, and you should just look at the intent to treat, which is the orange bars, is that the results look quite good. These are cirrhotic patients, and we're seeing about two-thirds of the patients are actually virus negative at week 16 of treatment. Now, what does the per protocol tell us? Well, the per protocol looks very impressive. So per protocol means the patients who actually are able to get through that 16 weeks of treatment, who didn't have a virological breakthrough, who didn't meet a stopping rule, and who tolerated the treatment. So if you have all those things and you get to week 16, you're already 92% of those patients are virus negative, by definition, in fact. Now, bosipivir looks a little less efficacious, I would say, but looks good. So this is now looking, remember, there's a lead-in with PEG and ribavirin alone with bosipivir, and so that's why the week four results don't look very impressive because they're just on two drugs. But then you add the bosipivir, you can see by week 16, the 58% of patients are virus negative. So these are results that I think are actually incredibly encouraging. We lacked data on cirrhotic patients. We didn't know how the drugs were going to work when we moved into that population. This looks quite good. Now, what about the safety? Because that's really the other concern, and really this is, I think, where we have to pause. So premature discontinuation of therapy, regardless of the PI, about a quarter of the patients are going to have to stop due to either stopping rules or adverse events. And you can see the adverse event rate here in this study looks a little higher with telaprevir than with bosipivir. There have been deaths. And you can see that within the first 16 weeks that they've had a total of six deaths across these patients. The overall percentage is low, but 0.5% for bosipivir, 2.6% of the patients have died in the first 16 weeks. And you can see that things that occurred, like infection and hematic decompensation, again, are seen in about 2 to 3% of patients. So it happens. The more important thing that just came out at the most recent liver meeting was who are the patients that get those severe complications, because that's what we need. And you can see that they're using a combined endpoint here of death, severe infection, or hepatic decompensation. And there were two factors that came out as being important: patients who had a platelet count less than 100 and those that had an albumin level less than 3.5. So it's telling us it's the patients with portal hypertension and the patients that have some impairment of liver synthetic function, and really points to the importance of the albumin as a marker, early marker, I would say, of individuals who might be at risk for decompensation or other more serious complications. Now, this is the NAPA meeting, so I have to talk to you a little bit about the UCSF experience. And we've been treating basically since about August of 2011. We really kind of embarked on a protocol. And we use kind of a very typical protocol. We tend to do a little bit more telaprevir than bosiprevir. You'll see that when I present our results. The other thing that we do is that we would use a lead-in of PEG and ribavirin regardless of the protease inhibitor if we think that the patients are going to have difficulties with tolerability. So lead-in in our hands is not restricted to patients with bosiprevir. And then in terms of the PI choice, as I mentioned to you, we tend to use telaprevir, but if we have a patient who's a Child's B, an early Child's B, then the package insert would not support the use of telaprevir because we actually don't know how to dose it in patients who have early Child's B disease. So if we have somebody with early Child's B disease, we would always use bosiprevir. So these are the characteristics of the patients we've seen. And what we did in this analysis was divide them by the median MELD score in our group. And it's actually a nice number, 8, because it kind of would be a number that I think most of you in the room would say, well, that's not a very high MELD score, and I'm okay with treating this patient. And it was really trying to give a sense of kind of where is the cutoff for a patient that can get safely through this or not. What I'll just point out is a few things about the patient population is that, you know, we're a transplant program, and so often we are seeing patients that are either on the list already and now referred for treatment or going to be. And you can see that clearly patients that have higher MEL scores tend to be the patients that we put on the list as our backup as we proceed through treatment. You can see that in terms of the child's puce, oops, let's move it through here. You can see that we tend to have about, in the patients that have the lower MEL scores, we tend to treat people that have more favorable characteristics like an IL-28BCC genotype, and there's fewer null responders in that group as well. You can see that the group that we're treating that have the high MELs, I can tell you that those are patients in which we're really hopeful that we'll get a response, and often those are the patients that are on the wait list and we're just hoping for an on-treatment response. And overall, direct you to the bottom. You can see that the Child's Pugh scores overall are low, 5 to 6. So these are Child's A's for the most part. We do have some Child's B in the MELD grade and A group, the intercortical range, as you can see. And then, as I mentioned, we do use lead-in in the patients that have higher MEL score where we're more concerned about tolerability, especially from the point of view of cytopenias. That would be a situation in which we'd use a lead-in. Now, our overall response rates are a little different than the kind of reports in the sense that we now are looking at it by MEL. So overall, our virological on-treatment responses, we've got RVR here, which is week 4 results, and CEVR, which is your week 12 results. And overall, our overall response rates are around 55%. But you can see that there's actually a fairly impressive difference, although this is not statistically so because our numbers are low, between those that have low MEL scores versus those that are high. And you can see that in those that have MEL scores that are greater than or equal to 8, that our overall on-treatment response rates are only about 40%. Now, that's a combination of several things that are coming into play. One is, remember that that's a group of patients in which they're more difficult to treat. So they're more likely to have more severe cytopenia, so we might be limited in terms of our doses. There also were more patients that had unfavorable response characteristics, more null responders, more partial responders, more non-CC genotypes. But that being said, this is the numbers. I'm going to point out to you that in that group, I did say that many of the times when we're treating the higher MEL scores, these are patients in which we're trying to get them to transplant and make them negative going into the transplant. And so now I'm going to flip to another data set, and this is the A2L data, which was a study, a multi-center study done through the A2L network, of which UCSF was one of the sites. And this was back in the PEG ribavirin days where we were trying to do the same thing, treat just to make the patients negative going into therapy. And what we learned during that time was, we learned it was difficult as well, but the important thing was that there needed to be some duration of HCV negativity in order for the patient to remain virus-free post-transplant. And with PEG and ribavirin, it was found that generally the highest rates of, you know, having somebody be negative after transplant were patients who were negative for at least 15 weeks before their treatment. Now, what we've learned in the very few patients we've had so far that have gone to transplant on after receiving triple therapy is the number of weeks of negativity appears to be less, needed is less, and that most of the patients that we now are putting on treatment, our goal is to have those patients be on treatment long enough to have their HCV RNA be undetectable for 4 weeks or more. So we don't think that we need to have this long period of negativity that we needed when we were just using PEG and ribavirin alone. Safety, this is our safety data, and I'm not really going to highlight too much out of this other than to say we do dose reductions, we use growth factors, we occasionally need to use transfusions. We have a discontinuation rate due to AEs. The thing that I wanted to point out is those that discontinue treatment because of adverse events or a virological failure, if we look at those patients, they're also taking a little bit of a hit in terms of their MEL scores. And part of that is that we're seeing that as these people are not responding and developing adverse events, oftentimes that's the situation in which we're seeing some decline in their MEL scores as well. So vigilance in terms of looking at the MEL scores as you take the patients through treatment is worthwhile, and always with the awareness that if you see a change in their MEL score, if that patient is not somebody who's already on the list, that would be somebody that you'd want to be contacting us to try to get that patient on the list, you know, as they're going through their treatment. Oops, sorry. Now, a little bit of information about kind of adverse events related to patients who are on treatment versus those that are not. Because all the data I showed you, whether it's the CUPIC data from Europe, whether it's our own UCSF experience where I'm showing you the number of adverse events and the number of complications we've had, you could say, well, you know, transplant patients with cirrhosis, patients on the wait list, they have those complications. So how do we know that the treatment's making it worse? And this is the best data that exists. And this is a publication that's going to come up in Hepatology. I think it's out. Just came out a month or two ago. It's the only control study that's been done where they took patients and we randomized them to getting treatment or just being followed. So the control group or the untreated group here is in green, and patients who got PEG and ribavirin are in purple. And the idea here is that it points out the complexity in treating patients with cirrhosis. And you are going to have more adverse events. Essentially, 100% of patients are going to have adverse events. And serious adverse events, the thing that lands people in hospital, requires them to have interventions, are much higher in patients who are on treatment than those that are not. And to date, there's been no real increase in the death rate. And as you can see here, there was a death rate in the context of this study, but no different in patients who were on treatment that were not. But remember that in this study, every single patient who was on treatment was on the waiting list. And I can't emphasize enough that if you're going to be doing treatment and recognizing that there's this SAEs, you've got to be very thoughtful about, does the patient need to be listed before I actually move forward with treatment? And the one thing that's kind of very obvious is that we have many more infectious complications. Those are shown on the far right. And you can see here that there's a higher rate. Again, the treated patients are in purple. So pre-transplant, more infections. Post-transplant, more infections. And even post-transplant, more infections that go beyond 30 days. So there's a kind of a price paid by the patient who's exposed to a PEG interferon therapy that they're going to have more infections both before, while they're on treatment, and actually there seems to be an infection risk that carries over into the post-transplant phase. So to summarize, in terms of your pre-treatment, PI triple therapy, I think, is appropriate. It is definitely giving us more individuals who are going to get on-treatment responses, and therefore I think we have a greater opportunity to do good. I think the Child's ACE cirrhotics are your best candidates, and the ones that I really favor for consideration of treatment are those that have cancer, because we know they're going to go to transplant in a very specific fashion as they march up the list, and they're also usually patients that have low MEL scores, and we really also really preferentially like to treat our living donors because we can time the treatment almost exactly to when the patient's negative if they're going to respond. The risk-benefit, I think, has to be also considered. You have to look at your patient and say, is this patient likely to get an on-treatment response? And the best patients are those that are relapsers, they have the favorable IL-28B genotypes, or those that have low viral loads. In terms of the treatment specifics, I just want to remind you that, you know, there is a label that says telaprevir should not be used in anybody's a child's B. So just keep that in mind. Bosiprevir can be used across the child's PEW scores. I think the lead-in is something to think about using because it can help you to establish tolerability. If you put your patient on PEG and ribavirin and you can't keep them on ribavirin, then there's no point in treating that patient with a protease inhibitor. And the optimal duration of the HCV RNA negativity before transplant, as I said, that I think is an evolution. But my sense is that with PI triple therapy, that the period of time that we need them negative before they go to transplant is much more truncated. So as I mentioned, the PI triple therapy is achieving on treatment responses in about 60%. Keep in mind that you're going to have to deal with the problems of cytopenias. And I can't kind of state enough that you if you don't use growth factors, it's very difficult to get the patients through treatment. But remember that both L-trombopog and EPO are off-label use, and they both have fairly significant side effects and kind of black box warnings. So if you're going to use them in your patients with cirrhosis, you need to have a very careful discussion with them about those risks. And then finally, among those that have stopped treatment due to adverse events, we sometimes see a little bit of a flare as we stop the treatment, and that can sometimes result in worsening of liver function. It happened in 50% of the patients we've treated and had to stop treatment in. So just to be very vigilant. So when you finish treatment, it doesn't mean you're finished following closely. You have to actually follow very closely in the immediate time following the discontinuation of treatment. High rates of adverse events. I think the key things in terms of management is just to be incredibly vigilant about following them closely. You know, we do blood work like CBCs every week. We're doing full liver panels every 2 to 4 weeks. We see them very often. And I think unless you've got sort of that dedication to following them very, very closely, then it's impossible to take them through this safely. And I would encourage you to work very closely with the transplant team. You all are going to be treating patients with cirrhosis. We certainly don't need every one of those cirrhotic patients referred for evaluation. But if you have a question or a concern about a patient and whether they need to be considered for transplantation, we're just a phone call away. And I think it's very easy for us to kind of often talk through whether it's appropriate to refer the patient or not. And some of you have also, you know, had patients come to see us just as kind of a one-time consult just to get that information. I think that's also another strategy. But work closely with us. We want to be sure that we're there for your patients in terms of being the backup if they should decompensate in the context of treatment. Now, moving on to the post-transplant. I'm going to have to talk even faster. Okay. This is the state of the art, as it were, with PEG and ribavirin. And the bottom line is that our SVR rates were poor. At best, if you look at the world literature, about 30% of patients who were treated with PEG and ribavirin post-transplant achieved an SVR. At UCSF, our results were not that much different. We usually had between 35 to 40% of our patients with PEG and ribavirin that were successfully treated. So the PI triple therapy was really an exciting kind of event in that we had many patients post-transplant who'd already been treated with PEG and ribavirin, and we were desperate to get another drug therapy. And we would predict that the PI triple therapy would increase the proportion of patients that we can cure because we know that we get more on treatment responses. But to date, and I'll tell you, even as I speak to you now, there are no SVR data that have been presented or published. So we're moving forward with PI triple therapy, but we don't actually know what our ultimate SVR rates are going to look like. The considerations with the use of PI triple therapy is that, remember, it's only for our genotype 1 patients, and we've got issues that are the side effects and the tolerability. But the other big issue with the post-transplant patients are the drug-drug interactions, because the PIs for hep C have significant interactions with the calcineurin inhibitors and sirolimus. And this is just a table. These are the published data. They did some very nice work to actually guide us with respect to what those drug-drug interactions look like. And what the short sort of version of this is that their drug-drug interactions are much greater with telaprevir than they are with bosiprevir, but both drugs significantly increase the levels of the calcineurin inhibitors. So what this means is when you have a patient who you are starting on treatment and you add telaprevir or bosiprevir to the regimen, their calcineurin inhibitor levels go very high. So there has to be a very rapid drug adjustments. Otherwise, you're going to find your patient getting toxic, specifically renal toxicity. The flip side is when you stop the PI, their calcineurin inhibitor levels drop very rapidly, and that's when they're at greatest risk for getting rejection. So it's a tricky business in terms of taking patients through with these drugs coming on and off a backbone of PEG and ribavirin. So I'm going to present data that actually was just presented at the ASLD meeting, but it's the best data that exists and I think is very helpful in terms of really giving a sense of what it looks like. This is the CRUSH-C consortium, of which UCSF is, we were actually the founding members of this CRUSH-C group, but it's a very important group. It's 5 large centers in the United States that are really pooling together their data about the use of protease inhibitors in transplant recipients. And this data was presented by Jay Burton at the recent ASLD meeting. So we have 101 patients in total that have been treated. It's a predominantly a telaprevir-treated cohort with 90% receiving telaprevir. And all of the centers kind of do the same thing in that we use a lead in of PEG and ribavirin to establish tolerability of the two drugs before we add the third. So 96% of patients got a lead in. And as you can see from the diagram at the bottom, for some of patients, the lead in was very long. And what those patients were is the patients we had on PEG and ribavirin, and we were waiting for the PIs to be approved, and so we just have these very long periods. So as you can see, in the patients that had lead-ins, we have some patients who had lead-ins that were like, you know, half a year. So it just really represents those patients that were on this kind of maintenance kind of therapy waiting for the PIs. But for those that had a lead-in, the median duration of the lead-in was about 1 month. So these are what the patients look like. Can I? Oh, I do have a pointer. Okay, so maybe I can actually just take you through it. To just make the point, I've divided them here into the lead in less than 90 and greater than 90. Probably the most representative group is that less than 90 group. And you can see that in general, we have a good representation of patients that we have 10% blacks and about 25% Hispanic. Of course, all genotype 1 with a predominance of genotype 1A, which we know tends to be, you know, less responsive to PI triple therapy. In terms of the IL-28B, 45% of them had less responsive genotypes. And you can see that we have a good proportion of patients that were null and partial responders. And not too surprisingly, because the thrust of most of us that are doing treatment post-transplant is we're focused on the patients that we think need it the most. You can see that 47% of the patients had F3 or F4 fibrosis, and 8% of patients had fibrosing cholestatic hepatitis. Now, in terms of the months from transplant, most of them were several years out from transplant, and you can see that in the group that had the very, very long lead-in, they really are the group that were most desperate. You can see most of them were null responders, 80%, and the other part were 20% partial, so a more difficult to treat group. Oops. Now, in terms of immunosuppression, what's interesting is that most of us had our patients on cyclosporin-based immunosuppression. And you'll say, well, that's kind of odd because usually at UCSF we use a tacrolimus-based protocol, and that is true. But what we did for this study and what other sites did as well is we transitioned our patients from Prograft to cyclosporin because we knew that the drug-drug interactions with the protease inhibitors were less with cyclosporin. So indeed, that's reflected in these data. You can see that most of the patients were off steroids and about two-thirds were on MMF. So these are the early virological responses for the cohort. And you can see that this is the viral loads when we started. The mean viral load was 6.6 logs. And you can see that after that lead-in period of about 1 month, we had 61% of the patients had at least a one-log drop. And then beyond that, when we get to week 2, week 4, week 12 of therapy, the median decline in the viral load during that time was 3.8 log. And if we look at the proportion of patients who are virus negative between weeks 4 and 12, you can see that it rises from 55 to 71% of patients. And overall, an extended RVR, which means they're virus negative from week 4 through to 12, was seen in 57% of patients. Now, what was interesting is, and not that surprising, I guess, is that patients who showed a response during PEG ribavirin during the lead-in were much more likely to actually be successful with treatment. So this is pretty consistent with what we know in non-transplant patients. So you can see that if they didn't have a one-log drop during the lead-in, only a third of those patients actually became negative with subsequent treatment. But those that had at least a one-log drop during that first 4 weeks of PEG and ribavirin, that two-thirds of those three-quarters of those patients actually are now HCV RNA negative on treatment. We have seen virological breakthroughs. Not surprisingly, I think, to me at least, they were more common in patients who had long lead-in because these are a more difficult-to-treat population. 14% of patients had adverse events that led to early discontinuation of therapy. And again, that was actually seen more frequently in the patients that had been on PEG and ribavirin for longer periods of time before we started the PI. Now, what about the immunosuppression dosing? And this is just to give you a sense of how much change occurs. So this is the median cyclosporin dose before we started the PI. So On average, 200 milligrams of cyclosporine per day. And after we start the PI, the average dose of cyclosporine is 50 per day, so a 75% reduction. For those that are on tacrolimus at the time that we're adding the PI, so average dose prior to PI was 1 milligram per day, and there's a 90% reduction in the PI. So actually, it works out to be somewhere around like 0.5, somewhere between every 5 to 7 days. It doesn't come without some cost, and the cost is really with respect to managing the cytopenias. So 49% of patients required a blood transfusion, and the mean number of units of blood that were required during the first 16 weeks of treatment were 2.5 per patient, with the maximum, I think, in the cohort was up to 14 units in 16 weeks. Use of growth factors in 86% of patients, with GCSF used in 44, EPO used in 79, and dose reductions, as you can see. PEG interferon is actually something we seem to be able to manage fairly well, but ribavirin dose reductions were required in 78% of patients. And even though we tended to start out with doses of 600 to 800 and up to 1,000, most patients required a dose reduction, and on average, most patients were on somewhere between 2 to 600 milligrams per day. Now, I mentioned to you that this art of adjusting the calcineurin inhibitors, even in experienced centers like ourselves and the partners that we have, you can see that a third of the patients still had a rise in their creatinine of more than 0.5 from baseline during the course of treatment. And so this kind of really reflects the challenges of getting the cyclosporine dosing correct. We have noted, interestingly, that rashes are actually very rare in our patient population. We think that might be related to the fact that they're on immunosuppression, perhaps. We've had 2% of patients who had rejection, one when they transitioned off the PI and one with a late rejection. 21% of patients required hospitalization due to an adverse event, with the most common ones being anemia and infection. And we've had 2 deaths. One related to sepsis and one with hepatorenal syndrome. And both these were patients, as you can imagine, that had fairly advanced liver disease. So what we've learned, because this is a very important, I think, collective experience, is that we can get these high rates of on-treatment responses, and that, in particular, that lead-in and looking how patients respond during lead-in is very, very predictive of whether we're going to get them to be negative during treatment. I think that's very useful. Anemia has been a huge problem, with even aggressive use of dose reductions and growth factors. We still needed to give transfusions in nearly half the patients, and 7% have required hospitalization for severe anemia. The significant interactions between the calcineurin inhibitors and the protease inhibitors, I've just demonstrated to you. It really requires a lot of intensive monitoring around the times that you start and then take away the PI. And many of the adverse events that we're seeing are specifically related to this drug-drug interaction, the worsening renal failure in a third of patients, and the rejection that we have seen. Now, really to summarize the positives, I think, with PI triple therapy is that we are, I think, going to have more people get SVR. But as I just said, we have very few patients who have actually completed treatment so far. The negatives are pretty clear from this presentation. Side effects are greater. Discontinuation rates are going to be higher. We got lots of drug-drug interactions to worry about. And then the real kind of question that nobody really has thought about, and I've thought about it, but I haven't got an answer yet, and that is, you know, we're going to have a fair number of non-responders. They're going to have resistance to the protease inhibitors. And then really, how is that going to limit their future therapies? Because they're immune compromised, I think we're not really clear about the natural history of that resistant mutation population, a virus. So I think consequences could be greater in post-transplant patients who get resistance. Now, I'm going to, I can't kind of get off the stage without saying something about all orals, because it was kind of the rage at the ASLD meeting this year, and it is really just very much our future. So we've got lots of new drugs coming down the pike, as you know, and while the first next wave of DAAs is actually going to be DAAs that are going to be used with PEG and ribavirin, they're just different classes of drugs. But I think what was the huge excitement at the meeting this year was really getting away from interferon and using all oral combinations. And this is so, so relevant for the populations I'm just speaking about today. The problems we're challenged by is just the use of PEG interferon in the cirrhotic population and then in a post-transplant population. So moving away from an interferon-based therapy is something that is incredibly attractive to those of us who are taking care of these patients. So let me just give you a few few studies. These were all presented at the recent ASLD meeting, and I'm just trying to give you a sense of what the future looks like. This is data from using dacladasvir and sofosbuvir, which is the new name given for the GS7997 drug. So dacladasvir is an NS5A inhibitor, and sofosbuvir is a polymerase inhibitor, so different classes than the protease inhibitor that we currently have. And they were used with and without ribavirin, and they were treated for 24 weeks. These are treatment-naive patients, and there are no cirrhotics in this patient population, so just keep that in mind. But you have to admit that the results are impressive nonetheless. Essentially, 100% of patients with genotype 1A, 1B are responding to basically three drugs, all oral. It's quite amazing. And genotype 2, there's some smattering here, but essentially it's somewhere between 93 to 100% of patients who actually are getting a response. So this is really remarkable, and there's a lot of buzz about sofosbuvir. And it's a very powerful drug, not a potent drug in the sense that it has a very high barrier to resistance, and so it's a very good drug in combination. But dacladasvir, and we've got all kinds of really cool and interesting drug combinations to use. I'm just going to give you a little bit more data, though, in that looks so impressive, and it's really got the wow factor. But what was interesting at the meeting is they also presented data in the more difficult-to-treat populations. So this is the same drug, sofosbuvir. There's no dacladasvir here. It's just the two sofosbuvir with the ribavirin. But now they're doing it in what we'd call a more difficult-to-treat population. These are African-Americans. They've got unfavorable IL-28B genotypes, and they are 48% of them had advanced fibrosis. So this is what, you and I are treating. And it's just to point out that when you do that, the numbers do drop off a little bit. So just look down at this one here, and you can see that the overall intent to treat SVR rates are between 64 and 75%. So it's no longer 100% or 90%. It does drop off a bit when you have the more difficult to treat population. But that is still a remarkable number for really two drugs in a difficult to treat population. And just to give you a sense that there are other drugs out there, this actually was presented at EASL, but this is another combination of drugs. In this case, it's a boosted PI in conjunction with a non-nuke, another drug class, and ribavirin. And you can see that they're treating, what's remarkable here is we're treating only for 12 weeks. And then it's 12 weeks of follow-up, and you can see the SVR rates in treatment-naive patients are essentially 95%. And this was a group of prior non-responders, and with 12 weeks of treatment, 48% response. So this is the future. And I do want to let you know that we actually are already doing studies in our transplant populations with all-oral therapies. We just finished enrolling a study in which we treated waitlisted patients with HCC who are Child's A, with the sofosbuvir and ribavirin. And the goal there was to have these patients treated, as they go into transplant or up to 24 weeks. So we just finished enrolling that. No results available yet. And already listed on the www.clinicaltrials.gov is a post-transplant study that we're going to be participating in which we're, again, going to be using sofosbuvir and ribavirin to treat patients with recurrent disease post-transplant. And I can tell you, having just come back from the meeting, that many other of the pharmaceutical companies are actually interested in these really important populations. So I envision that more studies will be coming. So I just want to end with saying, I think we've been really challenged over the last year with our PI triple therapy, but I think made really important inroads in terms of how to do it well. But really, when we look to the future, I think it looks incredibly bright for our HCV-infected patients. Thank you.
Eddie.
Right. Okay. So are you talking globally or in like a cirrhotic population?
Okay.
Okay. So the question, just to catch everybody up, is really the situation in which you have somebody who's got very favorable characteristics. In this case, it was specifically a CC genotype, and who during the first 4 weeks of treatment, this is assuming you're doing lead-in, shows a rapid virological response and is virus negative at that point. And the question is, what's the value of adding a DAA at that point? And that study actually needs to be done. I think in the non-cirrhotic population, I think that the data would suggest that there's not a lot to be gained by adding a DAA in somebody who's got an RVR. I think the cirrhotic population is different, though, because remember right now with PI triple therapy that the requirement for all the cirrhotics is that we should be treating for 48 weeks. And there's very, very limited data on what's the difference between 48 weeks versus 24 weeks, but there are some. And it's a substantial difference in terms of the response rates. So for that population, it seems like that the cirrhosis is adding something in terms of the difficulty in treating. So in those that have very favorable early responses, I still favor in a cirrhotic patient to add the DAA. So, and that's my approach, just based on an absence of data, but knowing that cirrhotics in general have lower SVR rates than non-cirrhotics. And we don't know if... those that have RVR but then don't get exposed to DAA may be at higher risk for relapse thereafter. So focusing on cirrhotics, I would say that even if I had somebody who had an RVR, I would favor adding the DAA. I'm sure it's probably not cost effective, but I, you know, when you treat a cirrhotic patient, you want to do it well, you want to do it once, and you want to, you know, give them every chance to be an SVR. And so for me, in the absence of data, I'm not going to make a decision not to use the DAA, even if they have RVR.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you. I think that makes sense, even except for the cost-effective.
Sure. And to make the point that it may still be cost-effective if you get a lot more responses, it may indeed be cost-effective, but nobody's done the study, and so it's a very difficult analysis to do. Yes. Sorry, I can't see. It's like blaring lights here.
Do you have any experience treating
FC
cirrhotics on dialysis?
Yeah. So I do. The question is, do I have any experience treating cirrhotic patients on dialysis with PI triple therapy? And so I've done a few. And what I can tell you, so there aren't data, unfortunately, about dialysis, but we do know that both of the PIs are really, it's metabolized through, you know, has hepatic metabolism, so we don't anticipate there'd be huge issues in terms of the renal failure component. The challenge, of course, with the patient on dialysis is that it's very difficult to keep them on ribavirin. And you cannot use the PI unless you can maintain the patient on ribavirin. So my approach to these patients is I tend to favor telaprevir only because it's a shorter period of PI exposure. And I know that the PI, ribavirin and PEG, are all going to contribute to the anemia risk. So I use telaprevir because I favor a PI exposure of 12 weeks versus 44 weeks. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that I use a lead-in, even though I'm using telaprevir, I use a lead-in to ensure that I can actually get the patient on a ribavirin dose that they can stay on. And it usually requires an amping up of their EPO, because they're all on dialysis and getting EPO, but they're going to need much more EPO when they're on treatment. And you have to kind of, you know, prepare the patient that it's going to be a little bit of a rocky course with the anemia. So I do a lead-in, get the ribavirin dose established. Usually it's 200 a day or 200 every other day is what I have really seen as being the typical dose. And once I'm confident that I can maintain their hemoglobin on that dose of ribavirin, then I would add in the telaprevir. Treat for 12 weeks and then, you know, assuming all the stopping rules, et cetera, apply. What I can tell you is it's been very difficult. They have really severe anemia. And the really, I think, challenging piece is that giving transfusions in patients who are going to get a kidney only, like, it's one thing if they're all set up, you know, but they're going to get sensitized. And so it's kind of a bigger deal with a patient who's a kidney transplant candidate to be giving them transfusions. When I have my liver patients, you know, I still have to talk about the risks of transfusions, but I'm not really worried about kind of compromising their future transplant. But for a kidney patient, you can actually sensitize them with the transfusions and actually compromise their future ability to have a kidney transplant. So I think it's really quite difficult. I do it in very select patients, to be honest with you. I'm not recommending it, to be frank. I think we need to learn more about how to do it safely to minimize the transfusion risk. And there may be, it may be that sort of second-generation PIs or other drug classes might be better suited to those patients. So that's my very long answer to your question.
How might they arrive after a kidney transplant?
I'm sorry?
After they receive the kidney transplant.
Okay, so I've done a few of those too. So, okay, so the question is, what about treating patients with PI triple therapy who've had a kidney transplant? So I have probably more of a comfort level doing that. So the concern in the kidney transplant population is really the exposure to the interferon and the potential to have rejection. And that certainly is a very big concern in among some nephrology communities, not at ours. Ours is very understanding of that whole issue and works very closely with me to help manage the immunosuppression during treatment. But I think it can be done. We've done it. We did it many, many times with PEG and ribavirin. And now with the PI triple therapy, that's kind of our new approach, our standard approach to somebody who's genotype 1. I will tell you that, like the post-transplant liver patients, cytopenias are an issue, and we still have to kind of, you know, we're still challenged by being able to keep them on doses. But I think they're like the liver transplant patients in the sense that you have to worry about the whole drug-drug interactions. I got to worry about cytopenias. But a priori, I don't really see them as that much different than the liver transplant patients in terms of thinking about doing treatment. We tend to, at UCSF, really only treat the kidney patients when they've got relatively advanced. You know, when they are showing progression, they get to F3, then we start to intervene with treatment. We're not doing it early. And I don't see any real reason to do that because we will have better drugs soon, and I think they can be more safely applied.
Last question. Can I ask you about the prophylactic antibiotics in the survivors?
Yeah. Right. Okay, so the question is, what about this recommendation about prophylactic antibiotics in patients who are cirrhotic? And there are data. It's not a prospective control trial, but there's a very nice study from Barcelona in which they looked at patients who were going through PEG and ribavirin therapy, and they specifically focused their study on infections, the incident of infections, the severity of infections. And it just turned out that in their study, some of the patients were on prophylactic antibiotics and some were not. And they show that the patients that were on the prophylactic antibiotics had a significantly lower rate of infections, SBP, overall infections, and actually there was a survival advantage.
So what did you use?
I varied a bit. I tend to use ciprofloxacin tends to be the one that I would use, but I've used Ceftra sometimes. If it depends on the patient. But yes, it's actually one of the things I think is a very important step. In that A2L study that we participated in, we started out the study without prophylactic antibiotics, and we actually had one of the deaths was like a sepsis death. And then we introduced, you know, the idea of doing prophylactic antibiotics, and we noticed that also our infection rates went down. So I think it's an important way to try to protect your patients against that complication.
So do you use the same dose as used for HPV?
Yes. Same. Correct. Yes.
One of your slides shows that if you use PI triple treatment before transplant, and even after transplant, the risk of infection stays high.
Correct.
Now, my question is there any benefit of drug allocation like oncology people do before you do the transplant, even if you pre-treat them? Could that cut down the risk of infection afterwards?
I don't know the answer. So the question is really that slide I showed you where from the A2L data, the patients who were on PEG and ribavirin coming into transplant not only had higher rates of infection before transplant, but also in the early and even later transplant period. I don't know. That's my short answer. I don't know about how to prevent that. I would not do prophylactic antibiotics in the post-transplant period. I would just recognize that a patient who's been on PEG and ribavirin may be at higher risk, and just to be vigilant and intervene when you identify infections. I don't think we would see it as a prophylactic setting. But, you know.
My point was that rather keep on giving the triple treatment until the point of transplant. Wasn't you stop for a certain period and then do the transplant?
Oh, good point. Okay. Sorry, I misunderstood your question. So the question is, why keep them on triple therapy right up to the time of transplant? Why not stop it to give them some kind of window without those drugs on board? while it's a good thought, it's difficult to do. You could potentially do it in a living donor, theoretically, because those ones we know exactly when they're going to go to transplant. But where every other patient, we never know when they're going to go to transplant. So that's difficult to implement. But the other concern I have is that oftentimes these patients on PI triple therapy, we've had them on treatment maybe 8 weeks. They're virus negative since week four. And I would be concerned that if I stop the treatment, that they might get a virological breakthrough before they get to transplant. So from my point of view, I think that's too risky. Because you've gone through all that effort of getting them on treatment, getting them negative, I would keep them on the drugs right up to transplant to ensure that you don't get a little blip in the viral load and they then be at higher risk for getting recurrent disease post.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.